Please raise your hand if you've lost a spouse. Just look around the audience and hold them up high. You'll see that there are several people here. You can put them down now. There are several people here who have lost a spouse, and each one of them understands the things that I'm talking about. And so I begin the lesson tonight by stating, as I did last evening, I'll not be telling you those things tonight that I have made up in my own bedchamber, those things that I have felt that nobody else has felt, and I want to come to tell you some kind of a sad story that I have experienced because I love my wife more than anyone else. It is not that at all. Every word that I speak tonight can be verified by every hand that you see held up tonight, because every person goes through those same experiences in some degree or another. And so tonight, we want to look at the subject of grief from a friend's standpoint. That is, what do we do when we hear that a friend has lost a loved one? I think that there are only two or three major questions in life that really we just are totally lost with and we don't know what to do. And out of all of those two or three that we might be thinking about, this is one that we seem not to be able to find an answer to. I know that I can truthfully say, until the day that my wife died, I had preached for 32 years, and there had not been a day of that time that I knew how to help a friend who had lost a loved one. There had never been a time that I had approached anybody at a funeral and that I knew what to say to that individual. Every time that I went to a funeral and every time that I approached someone, it was with a feeling of anxiety. It was with a feeling of remorse and a feeling of lostness, and I wanted to get it over because I really didn't know what to say. And so I would stumble along, I would say something, and then I would leave, and then the next time, I would know no more about it. Now, this is something that is common to all people. There's only one way that I know that we could learn what to say to an individual in that realm, and that is to study those people who have been through it. Ask the people who have been through it, what do you want people to say? What do you expect people to do? And I think we'll be amazed when we find those answers tonight. The answers are going to be so simple, and I believe that when you leave here tonight, that you will see that what I'm saying is true. You can verify it with any number of hundreds of people, and every one of them will tell you exactly the same thing. But it's going to be an answer to those problems of what do I do. Let's begin tonight by letting me read to you in 1 Chronicles chapter 27 and verse 22. It says, "And Ephraim their father mourned many days." Now we talked about that last night, how that an individual would mourn, grief from a mourner's viewpoint. But listen to the last verse of that. "And Ephraim their father mourned many days, and his brethren came to comfort him." Have you ever sat down and thought about that verse? Have you ever sat down and analyzed that and said, what does that mean? "And his brethren came to comfort him." Exactly what did they do when they came to comfort him? Well, if you don't know, let's turn to Job in chapter 1, verses 11 through 13. It said, "Now Job's three friends heard of all of this evil or terrible problems that come upon him. And they came every one from his own place and made an appointment together to come and bemoan him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. And they rent every one his robe and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great." Now the remaining part of the book of Job tells how these men failed in their job. But friend, do you realize that when we're introduced to these men that they loved that man Job? Do you realize that here are men who traveled from far countries and took many, many days and perhaps months to be able to get to Job to try to befriend him and try to help him? And when they came there, they came for the express purpose of comforting him. When they saw the amount of grief he had, it hurt them so badly that they, full-grown men, broke down and cried. Do you understand that they walked up to Job and they were hurt and they were lost and they never uttered a word for 7 days? Have you ever thought about that a great deal? Or have you done what I have done and you've read it and said, boy, that's a long time not to talk. and then go ahead and go over it. But you know, there was a reason that they didn't say anything for 7 days. Let me ask you, have you ever been so hurt over somebody else's loss that you were not able to speak for 7 days? You just sat and looked at an individual? What I'm telling you tonight is that there are people in this world that have tried to help other people, and the job is a tremendous job. Now, these scriptures clearly define what we're trying to talk about tonight. Let me read you two New Testament passages now that introduce us to the lesson and tells us this. In Romans chapter 12, verse 15, Paul says, "Rejoice with them that rejoice, and weep with them that weep." Do you know how to do that? That's why we're assembled here tonight. When people are weeping in the hour of their greatest loss, how do you weep with them that weep? In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 37, let's read when Jesus went out to the Garden of Gethsemane, and let's look at it from the viewpoint of what the Bible actually says. It said, "And he took with him Peter and two of the sons of Zebedee, and began to be sorrowful and sore troubled. Then saith he unto them, My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. Abide ye here and watch with me." You ever just sat down and think about that? Of what Jesus was actually asking? Or do we rush on and we get on in there to say, now what was he doing, and get on to some more important things? Do you realize what went through the heart of Jesus at this hour? When he went and got his three friends, the three close friends, and said, "Would you please come and watch with me for an hour?" You know what that means? I hope we'll be able to talk a little bit about it tonight. Of calling somebody and just saying, "Come," and don't say anything, just come and be with me. And then it says that Jesus was exceedingly sorry, and he said he broke down and he was sorrowful even unto death, until he almost felt like he was going to die. Now they went with Jesus, and Jesus went ahead and said, "Stay here," and he went on up a little ways and prayed and came back, and they were asleep. And think about what he said. He said, "What? Could you not watch with me for 1 hour? Couldn't you help me for just 1 hour? Couldn't you do what you're supposed to do to help me in my grief for just 1 hour?" Now, do we know what to do to sit down with an individual and talk with them and look at them and what to do? You see, the Bible is full of illustrations like this. And when we begin to look at it and we see these friends of Jesus and friends of Job, they came along a distance. They were hurt so badly they broke down and cried. They stayed with him for a period of 7 days. They came for the express purpose of comforting him. But they were misguided friends. And they botched the job, if we put it in colloquial language. Now, if people that loyal, if people came and did that, then it might behoove us to study the subject and ask, do we really do what we ought to do? Now, everyone feels uncomfortable around a griever. Let's face that. You feel that way. I feel that way. We feel totally lost. We feel totally lost because we don't know what to do. We know what we want to do, but we don't know how to do it. We want to bring comfort and happiness back into the griever's life, but we don't know what to do or what to say. We are embarrassed. We have to do something, so we make our appearance and say something, and then get going as quickly as possible. And it is indeed a comfortable feeling when we get out of the presence of a grieving person. Now be truthful, isn't it? It always has been to me. Very comforting when I could leave and didn't have to look at them anymore, and I could go out and get some coffee and go ahead and restore my life. Do you realize that in those hours that I've done that as a preacher, that I just violated James 2:14? I just went in and, just like James 2:14 says to somebody that needs clothes, I went in and said, be clothed and be warned. Goodbye. And I walked away. I went in, and what they needed, I was unable to give them, except I told them, I hope you the best. I give you my sympathy. And I turn around, and I walk away. It becomes an awesome thing when we look at it in that way, doesn't it? Now tonight, I want to tell you what to do and what to say. I want to make it so plain that I hope you'll never be uncomfortable again. The solution is simple. but you'd never know it unless you either experienced the loss of a loved one or had someone who's experienced it to tell you. What I'm going to say is not what I've made up. It's not merely my opinion. It's not only what I have experienced, but what every griever who has ever been interviewed has expressed. I want to emphasize that, because when I tell you tonight and start out telling you very definitely, I'm going to tell you what to do. I know that sounds cocky. I know it sounds egotistical. But I'm not telling you just from my viewpoint. I'm telling you after reading survey after survey, after all the studies have been made, I'm telling you that thousands upon thousands of people all agree in one thing of what we need to do when we go help somebody. So that's the reason I can be so dogmatic when I say it. And as I've written down here, I hope that if you'll listen closely tonight, that it can change your life forever. It can change you from stumbling, bumbling, embarrassed troublemaker into a confident person who can serve his fellow man with compassion in his greatest hour of need. And so that really is the important thing that we're after tonight. As I mentioned last night, we teach how-to classes. We teach how to teach, how to convert, how to preach, how to pray, how to wait on the table, how to treat your husband, how to treat your wife. Tonight, we want to talk about how do you weep with them who weep. Now, before you can truly comprehend these simple secrets, you first must understand how a griever really feels. And that's the subject of tonight's lesson. In just a moment, I'm going to get into what to say and what to do in some very specifics. But before we get into that, unless you understand how a griever feels, what happens to him, how that he actually feels, you'll feel uncomfortable and really not know whether it is true or false. Now, last night, we made the point that grief is a real thing, and I want to emphasize it tonight. We showed that the medical profession takes two things and sets them aside over here differently than any other thing. They put pregnancy and grief in one category, and they all admit that something happens to the human body and the human mind that needs medical attention and tension that is different than anything else, and yet they cannot be classified as a disease. The depression that an individual goes in, when he goes into grief, and everybody does, just go right down into depression, but you can't call it depression. It because it doesn't have the same effect. It has the same appearance, it causes the same pain, but a depressed person will continue to go on into it, and a depressed person will get worse and worse, but a grieving person will be able to help themselves and come on back out. And so the medical profession and the mental profession scratches their head and they say, every symptom is the same, but they are different. So what really happens? Something definite happens. Let me read to you from a book that I've taken right here, a quote from. And this is the book, really, that I've given on that list. I've only given two or three books. And I think that it's very valuable. Out of all of the hundreds of books that have been written on the subject, I think that if you will take those that I put on that sheet and you will read that, you will pretty well know everything that you need to know in all of those other hundreds. Most of them are scientific studies, and they're charts, and they're calculations, and they get down into minute little details. And of course, after I lost my wife, I had a burning desire, just because of the kind of guy I am, just a character. I like to study, I like to learn things, and I studied for a period of 6 months just without stopping, just reading and gobbling up everything that I could do. Reading until I would fall asleep of a night and doing that because I had a burning desire to learn everything I could possibly learn that human beings know about the subject of death. And so it was for my own benefit that I did that. And I realized that out of all of those things that I read, there's about three or four books that really tell you the entire story. And for the simplest one, it's this one right here that's written by this people here, Kreese and Pat. Now let me read you this. They say, let us look at grief. If you have known it, you will remember. If you haven't, imagine yourself suddenly alone in an alien world. Your body is weary, your emotions raw. Your headache is a real physical ache, and you're sure that your life is destroyed. You do not know how to think, how to stop feeling, how to start feeling, where to go, where not to go, what to do, what not to do. Your emotions are a mixture of childish anger, that this shouldn't happen to me, and a mature awareness that the one you loved is gone. And yet, paradoxically, for a while, you do not believe he's really dead. You feel trapped, betrayed, frightened. You feel guilt, anger, self-pity, and you long to share all these contradictory feelings with someone who understands, but you're afraid. All the conflicting emotions sink deep inside you. You wonder if you're going insane because you do not know if anyone else has ever felt as you feel. Then you, like your friends, play the game called Count Your Blessings. It is a hide-and-seek game. You hide your real feelings and seek approval from your friends by your strength in accepting grief with such good grace. The key word in the foregoing description of grief is afraid. All too often, grievers are afraid to confide their real feelings to others, and all too often afraid to admit their real feelings to themselves. And so they give us a brief description, really, of that conflict that we talked about and we'll talk about again tonight. Now then, as we proceed into this, let me state that all grievers really go through basically the same steps that we had up here last night. There are three major steps, and that is shock and suffering and recovery. Some people take longer to get through one stage than another, but basically you do go through all of them. Now, I think it's interesting in this way. When you say that every person suffers the same thing, I'm not saying every person suffers on exactly the same time schedule. But and I'm not saying that there is not a difference between men and women. Let me tell you some differences between men and women that's rather interesting in the suffering and in the grief stage. However, it doesn't mean that a man suffers more than a woman or a woman more than a man. But do you know what happens to a man in the first year after his wife dies, as far as his death rate is concerned? I mentioned it last night. His death rate shoots up from 4 to 10 times as high as the other men in his category. That means that during the past year, the chances of me dying were from 4 to 10 times as great as other men in my age. Now, do you know what happens to a woman in the first year after her husband dies, as far as her death rate goes? Not one thing. Not one thing. Her death rate is exactly the same as all the other women in there who have not lost their husbands. Isn't that amazing? But do you know what happens to her in the second year? In the second year, all of a sudden, her death rate just goes zoom and knocks the scale, the top right off of the scale. Now, a man's death rate just shoots immediately, just zoom, from the day his wife dies, and then on the curve, it goes down for a period of 5 years, and at the end of 5 years, he's back down now, and his death rate is the same as it was before his wife died. But the woman, her death rate goes up, boom, in the second year, it just goes flat the first, nothing happens to her, and then up the second year, which shows that the second year of a woman's grief is in many times even worse than the first year. And then it levels off, and then 5 years later, she's down there where the man is, and they both suffered exactly the same thing. Isn't that amazing? Then the social recovery. Men recover socially faster than a woman. However, the death hits a man, the impact of it harder than it does the woman, because women are more self-sufficient than men. They're able to go home, they're able to carry on life more self-sufficient, generally, but a lot of times not so financially sufficient, but self-sufficient in being able to do it. When I went home, I did not know, and to this day, I cannot make a cup of coffee. I have never cooked a dish in my life except one time when my wife was sick and we had some kids over and I cooked oatmeal and burned it and ended up giving them some Wheaties. If you ask me one dish to make, I cannot do it. Now, I can brag. I've learned to do something. I go home, and the doctor, by the way, took this away from me here the other day. But I learned how to buy Nestle's Quick and stir it up and make chocolate milk. Now, in 18 months, that's what I've eaten in my home. I learned how to buy cheese. I can use a cheese cutter and open crackers, and I will go home and cut cheese, open crackers, and mix up chocolate milk, and that has been my supper. Now, I know you women will laugh at that, but I'm proud of that, because that was a vast improvement when I was married. I wasn't able to do that, see? And in other words, I'm totally helpless. I didn't know how to wash. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know how to run the washing machine. I didn't know how to do one thing. I didn't know where the pots and pans were. Didn't want to see them. I didn't know anything. Totally, totally helpless. Now, had I died, my wife would have been able to go ahead for a period of time. All right? What I'm saying is that the first year, the impact on a man is just totally devastating. And then at the end of a year, he starts a social recovery that is very, very rapid. In fact, it shows that most men are married at the end of a year. And a woman hasn't even thought about going out on her first date at the end of a year. It takes her a year before she even considers, most of the time, going out on her first date. Now, there's always exceptions to these things, but I'm talking about what the surveys really show. And the surveys show that if a man is not married in 2 years, generally, he will not remarry. He gravitates toward one way or the other. Either he will marry or he will not in the second year. And if he hasn't by the end of the second year, he probably, the chances are, will not remarry the remaining part of his life. But a woman doesn't even consider that until after the second year or 3, 4, or 5 years before she is ready to begin to think about it in that realm. And so there's a vast difference between a man and a woman. Men generally say when their spouse is dead, and I felt this, and one day I read it in a book, and I said, well, that's what I've been saying. I felt that part of me was gone. And that's what I would say. It's I have been cut in half. And I think to tell you that the way I felt, when I say part of me is gone, I felt like that somebody had taken a chainsaw and just started at the top of my head and sawed me right in two. Taken one half of my body and buried it, and then patted the other half on the head and says, Lowell, go make a good life for yourself. Now that's the way I felt. Totally helpless. Part of me was gone. Now most women will feel, and their remarks will be, he left me. Why did he leave me right now? I'm left alone. I've been abandoned. And they began to feel in this way. Yeah, there's a difference between a man and a woman. Who suffers the most? The suffering is the same. The point that we're getting at, the suffering is the same, even though there is those emotional traumas. Now, there's another thing. There's a difference between sudden death and terminal death. The death of my wife was sudden death. Not expecting it, not at all. And all of a sudden, in just a matter from Monday to Friday, and she's gone. And yet there are a lot of others that their wives will be eaten away with cancer for months or for years, and the agony they go through. Who suffers the most? Well, the answer is, what they found is, the suffering is the same. And what happens is the person that has to go through that long terminal suffering, which John Overton, who was here last night, I don't see him tonight, I think he's here though, had to go through with his wife. That long suffering that I didn't have to go through, of watching her die of cancer, and the torment that he went through, going through some of these things, and then when she died, then his trauma at that hour was not with the impact that my trauma was at that particular hour. Who suffered the most? We both suffered exactly the same. John had to suffer over a period of time. Mine was just fell on me like a bulldozer. But when you put it all out, if you could measure suffering, and you say that suffering, that you have to go through 2,000 pounds of suffering, well, you have to go through it. Whether you go through it over a 6-month period of time, 3 months before the death, 3 months after, or whether it's all one period of time, studies show you go through the same amount of suffering. And so the idea is, it's generally said, that a sudden death is easier on the person that dies, but it's harder on the survivor. And the person, and the terminal is harder on the person that is dying, but easier on the survivor in that they go into it. But the amount of suffering is actually the same. Now then, let's look at this and understand that there will be some different feelings, but everybody goes through these feelings. Now, the first one is shock that we talked about last night. Now, what do you do? How do you feel? And what do you do when you hear that somebody's died? So, we put here, this is generally the stage in which you will find your friend, unless it has been several weeks or months since the death. But upon hearing of the death, now here's step number one. When you hear that a friend has lost a spouse, you go to them immediately. Do exactly what you don't want to do. If it's at 10 or 11 o'clock of night, you'll say, well, I certainly don't want to bother them tonight. They have so many problems on there that I certainly wouldn't go and bother them and barge in their house tonight. And so, all you're doing is kidding yourself. All you're doing is giving yourself an excuse for not going and doing what you ought to do. Now, what you ought to do is go and go immediately. Immediately. Put your clothes on, get out of bed, and go. And you say, are you sure? Positive. How are you sure? Because that's what every person that's ever gone into grief will tell you that they would like for you to do. People have told me, come around, and they said, Lowell, said, we didn't come out there because we knew there'd be a lot of people out there, and we knew, you know, it would just be a burden on the house and all of this. And I wouldn't have cared had they stopped the traffic and it had been lined up for 5 miles. It wouldn't have made me any difference. I was a man with problems. I wasn't interested in sleep. I wasn't interested in whether the house is dirty. I wasn't interested in any of those things that people thought I was interested in. I wasn't interested if the kitchen was full. I was interested in one thing, the most traumatic event that could ever happen to a human being. It happened to me, and I needed help. Right? Now remember that. So go, and go immediately. If you can't get there, pick up the phone and call. You say, what do you say? Well, we'll talk about it right here in just a minute. But do something. Make contact and go with them. Now, when you go, there's absolutely no way to tell how you'll find them. They may be staring into space. They may be acting as though nothing happened. They may be happy and cheerful. That happens a lot of times. They may be conducting themselves anywhere in between. But one thing is for sure, they're in shock. That person is in shock at whatever they're doing. They may be laughing and joking, and all that person is doing is denying it. They have shut it out. They're not able to take it and accept it in their mind, and so they have shut it out. And they said, no, something is wrong. The doctor is wrong. I will not accept it. I will not. They shut it out. It's a psychological manipulation that God made man to be capable of doing for his own protection. Now, when they came over and found me, the people that described me, I remember I was sitting in a chair. I was just sitting there, and I was staring. And I remember when the people came in, and as they started to walk in the room, they started to walk in, and they backed up, just like something terrible was in that room. And these were my close friends. I had about 30 or 40 people to come that night. They got to the hospital through the Seattle traffic. It just seemed like immediately, and I appreciated it so much. But they were afraid to come in that room. And they told me the other day, they said, we'll never forget the sight. Said, you sat there as white as a sheet. You were in an unbelievable stupor. They said it was the most frightening, scary scene that we've ever experienced. That we did not know how to handle the situation. And they didn't come in that room. And I got up and I went out because they froze at the door. But that didn't make any difference. I'm just telling you the reaction that you get. Be prepared for any kind of reaction because that person is in shock. Now, what happens when you're told of the death? What is that person going through so you'll know what to say? All right, let me read you to make it expedient. It feels like sticking your finger into a light socket is really what it is, as I explained last night. It just feels like, just like that, you stick your finger in there, and total numbness happens immediately. Every nerve, muscle, and organ in your body reacts spontaneously. You're in shock. You've entered into a new world. You are in shock. What you do depends on your personality. You may deny it by laughing. You may try to reverse it by getting angry and even striking the doctor. In my case, I couldn't move. Your physical body immediately changes. Your immune system shuts down, your muscles become uncoordinated, your nerves seem to be short-circuited, and your body is numb and unresponsive. Your mind has immediately accepted the fact that your life has ended, but you must go on living. Fear fills your total being. You immediately become afraid of everything. The past is gone, the present is horrible, and the future is so bad that you cannot comprehend it. Your mind is now operating in opposite directions. You think only in extremes. You think of every subject on an emotional and an intellectual level, and they're always going in the opposite direction. What you want, you fear. what you fear you want. You look to the future, and yet you know that you'll not be here tomorrow. When you think you'll die, you're afraid you won't. And everything begins to work in that realm. Let me talk about that for just a moment, because I don't have it on down there. And that is that you go in this way, and I think I explained it best in the realm of a computer. Most of us know that in a calculator or computer, certain things happen. There are some computers that if you turn it on and you leave it on so long that it will turn itself off if you don't use it, you know, in about 10 or 15 minutes. Now, I have a watch here that has a calculator on it, and I put that thing over there in a calculator mode, running it, put it back on, and if I forget to put it back over in 10 minutes, it just automatically flips back over to the time, and I can tell what time it is. Now, your mind does the same thing. All of a sudden, you're walking along, and your emotions and your intellect are just going along, just like you are tonight. And when you're told that this loved one has died, they just separate. Your emotions and your intellect, and your mind operates on two different levels. You have an emotional level, and you have an intellectual level. And immediately, you are programmed into the emotional level. Everything you do is based upon emotions. Now, anytime you want to, you can switch to the intellect. If somebody had walked in at any moment and asked me any question they wanted to ask me, I could have flipped over to the intellect and I could have said, here's the answer. If they'd have come in and they said, Lowell, what should you do tomorrow? I could be there just crying my eyes out. I could wipe my nose, flip over, and I could tell them what I ought to do. And then I'd flip back into the emotional again. And in the emotional, I wanted to die worse than you've ever known anything in the world. Intellectually, I knew that I really didn't want to die. I didn't want to leave my children. I didn't want to hurt them. Intellectually, you name any subject, it didn't make any difference what it is. Intellectually, I wanted it this way. And emotionally, I wanted it this way. Intellectually, I wanted it the other way. Now, the best illustration I can give you is like this. It's like standing on a railroad track. And as you stand on a railroad track, you're looking down two tracks and they're separated. One is the emotion, one is the intellect. They run parallel. Way down at the horizon, way down, those tracks come together. Now that really is what grieving is. Grieving is being able to go through this period of time of when your intellect and your emotions go along together and they keep getting closer and closer and closer and closer until finally they're back together again. When they're back together, you've healed from your grief. But what I'm saying is that you're going to go through those two things. Everything is a contradictory pattern. You think both ways on everything. Now, concentration is impossible, yet you think you have it. Dialing a phone, even while you're looking at the numbers, becomes impossible. Walking becomes a heavy chore. Sometimes you cannot go from one room to another without sitting down. You try to make time move on faster and faster, and it goes slower and slower. And you pray that God will cause a year to zip by so you can be relieved. Yet you know He won't, but you think He might, just for you. Now, I know you think, Lord, you didn't do that. You know, I don't believe I would have put that in this paper tonight if a couple other people hadn't have told me that, and they're probably here tonight, but I don't see them. I sat down, and I knew that it would take a year. And at that table, I prayed to God, oh God, please make a year go by in the next 30 seconds. Isn't that dumb? I prayed that. I've been preaching for 32 years. I prayed that prayer. I wanted that more than anything in the world. I knew God wouldn't give it to me. Yeah, I thought maybe He will. Maybe He will. Maybe in my case, He will. I know He won't. Maybe He will. I know He won't. Maybe He will. And then I was talking to some others, and they just brought it out of a clear blue sky. And they said, Lowell, you know, said, I sat down and I prayed that God would make a year go by like that. And two people in Oregon have told me that they actually prayed that. And you can't believe some of the things that you will do. Now then again, here's the way these people put it, Chris and Patty. They say, for no matter how you act, you will feel pulled in two opposite directions. You will feel restless and too weary to move. You will feel hated and need love. You'll feel alienated and need sympathy. You'll feel mute and need communication. You'll feel isolated and need companionship. You'll feel half dead and half alive. You'll feel nothing and too much. You'll feel betrayed and abandoned, unloved, unloving, and unlovable. You'll feel guilty as a murderer and martyred as a saint. At times your awareness will be acute, but clear thinking will be an illusion. All these feelings disconnect you from yourself and your environment, yet it is then you need people desperately to remind you that the world still needs you. You still exist as an important person in your own community, wanted and loved for your own sake. And so I merely read that to you to show you that is the way that it is described, really, by all these people. Now then, how do you treat a person like that? When you go to the house and that's the way they feel, and you can just write that down, that's the way they feel. Now then, what do you do? How do you weep with them that weep in that way? Shall I read again from this book? It says, how do you help a friend in grief? Perhaps you telephone, send flowers to the chapel, or send a check to his favorite charity, go to the funeral, invite him to your place once or twice to buck him up, and then slip back into your own life, assuring yourself that you've done all you could do. That is not enough. A friend in grief needs you desperately, as much and sometimes more than he needs his family. And you as a friend have the power to help or hinder his recovery. That is how important you really are. Surprisingly enough, to help effectively takes only a clearer understanding of grief and a little extra time and a willingness to listen. Now, here are the things that I've listed of what you do. As soon as you hear that a friend is in grief, phone him and get to him as quickly as possible. I do not ask what you can do. This is what we always do. We went, what can I do anything? That, tell me if I can do anything. Silliest question on the face of this earth. They're not going to tell you anything. Just stop to think, and you need to remember this. That person sitting there in grief is just as smart as you are. I know you don't think so. You see them crying their eyes out and doing some silly stuff. They're just as smart as you are. They know more about you than you know about them. See, that's the problem. And that's what makes us look so silly, is because we go in there as an expert, acting like we know what to do, and say a bunch of silly things, and all the time that person is sitting there shaking their head, thinking, how dumb can you get? Now that's the actual truth of the situation. And don't go in and say, what can I do? You say, what do you do? You go in and do it. That's what you do. You have eyes. You can see what's done. Don't go in and ask them. They'll tell you no. If you come and you ask me, you say, Lowell, anything I can do for you while while you're in Salem? I won't tell you no. I've always told people that all their life. Now, if you really want to do something for me, come by and pick me up and say, Lowell, get in the car. Well, where are we going? Well, I'm going down to buy you a new suit. What did I say? It's Clem Lindsay. I'll say, yeah, let's go. See? But go buy me a new suit. Now, if you set on buying me a new suit, how you do it? You say, get in. You take me down, you buy me a new suit. I'm not going to tell you I want a new suit. I'm not going to ask you for a new suit. Now, when you come over to my house tonight, my wife died, what can I do? Nothing. That's what I'm going to tell you. I'll do it all myself. I was dumb enough to think I could, you see, but you're dumb enough to ask me. And so, what you do is, do it. Look around. Make phone calls. Bring food. Look, does a house need to be cleaned up? Just go in and do it. You can't imagine how thankful I was standing there watching people do things for me. Knowing that I could not do them and jumping in and doing those things. Just go in and do it. That's what you do. So it says here, once there, be alert. Does he need someone to answer the phone, someone to make calls, send wires, brew coffee, or just sit beside you? Offer physical contact, especially to a woman. Hold her hand, and if she greets you, and if when you greet her she clings, do not be afraid, even if you're a happily married man. To her in shock, you're just a comforting shoulder and no more. Usually in early grief, a person acts out of habit, much as they did before the death. Therefore, if he wants to talk, no matter what the subject, listen. All right now. What do you say? First of all, bite your tongue and don't ever utter a cliche. You say, what do you mean by a cliche? All those things that we say. Don't ever pat somebody on the head and tell them, time will heal. Don't ever say, you know, this is the best way because they don't have to suffer. Now, last night I told you about my wife. It's okay for me to tell, but don't you tell me that. See, don't you come and tell me, Lord, you know, you were really lucky to have your wife to die, weren't you? Now, I told you last night, I feel like a fortunate man that she didn't have to suffer. See? But don't you tell me that. And you can turn it around and you understand that you don't want people to do that. So don't tell me how lucky I am that my wife died, even in a nice way. And then don't say God loved them so much that he took them. See, no, that, If God loved them so much that he took them, what about me? I mean, if that's true. See, if you know so much about God and what God does, and God has confided in you, and you know that God just looked down and said, oh, Doris, Lowell's wife is so nice. I just have to have her in heaven. And so he took her. If you know that much, what do you think about me? Leaving me here with all of this, why didn't he take me? I prayed that he would take me. So all I'm saying is, even if you're right, you're not bringing me any comfort. So don't ever tell anybody, oh, God loved them so much that he took them. Don't ever come in and say, I know how you feel. I lost my mother last week. A woman came by and trying to be nice there at the funeral home and said that, and just burns up on the inside of you. What you think is, mother, you lost your mother. You see, I lost my wife. Now, I know you say, well, I've lost my mother and it couldn't hurt any different, Lord. Yeah, it can. We say, well, what about somebody who's lost their wife? What should they come in? Even if you've lost your wife, don't go up and say, I know how you feel. Now, you can go up and you can make some statements. And you can say, you must hurt so badly. I lost my wife a few months ago. And if the individual responds, he may not care whether you lost your wife. But you see, the way I felt about it was, so you did lose your wife. You didn't love your wife as much as I love my wife. Now, when you lost your wife, that's the way you felt about people that said that. See, that's the way we all feel. And your relationship wasn't like mine. And you want to know something? It wasn't. There's not a one of you had a relationship like Doris and I had. You say, what do you mean? You mean you loved her more than I love my wife? No, you may love your wife more than I love Doris. That just means we're different, right? You may not love her as much. That just means we're different, right? You may have loved her exactly the same as I love Doris, but you may know how to cook, and I didn't. See, all I'm saying is, there's not a man in this audience that has the same relationship with his wife that I had with my wife. It may be better and it may be worse, but it's not the same. And so at that time when the nerves are on edge, don't say, I know how you feel, because you don't know how that individual feels. So leave those cliches out. Don't go up and a person is just broken down and try to buck them up and say, now you're going to have to pull yourself together. I know I was just falling apart at the funeral home. My brother flew all the way out from Indiana. He came up and he grabbed me by the shoulders and he says, Lowell, buddy, said you're going to have to pull yourself together. You're going to have to pull it together. Just made me furious. That no comfort in it whatsoever. Sure, all I've done is lost my wife. All I've done is lost my whole life. All I want to do is die. I want to die worse than anything in the world. Just buck her up, old buddy, and make a good life. See? Yeah. It would be the same as if somebody came in and filled me full of machine gun bullets, and I fell down, and I didn't die, and somebody came up and cut off a leg and threw it over there, and Dave walks up here and says, Lowell, you're going to have to chin up, old boy. You're going to have a rough time ahead of you. I don't want to hear it. What he's telling me is the truth. I'm just saying that's not what you tell somebody at that time. Now, you want to know what the Bible says about it? And you say, oh, the Bible didn't say anything about that. That's what I'm saying. You don't realize a lot of things until you see it. Here's what the Bible says about it. In Proverbs chapter 25, verse 20, it says this. As one that taketh off a garment in cold weather, and as vinegar poured upon soda,